I'm Rhianna Patrick, and thanks for joining me here on Away across Australia on RN. Victorian-born dancer and choreographer Bradley Chatfield has travelled the world, from joining the Australian Ballet School at 15 to dancing for the Sydney Dance Company and the Hong Kong Ballet. He seems to have done it all. But now the award-winning performer is sharing his expertise with the next generation of Australian Indigenous dancers. Bradley recently became the head of dance at ACPA, the Aboriginal Centre for the Performing Arts in Brisbane. He's just finished choreographing ACPA's end-of-year production, Black Electric, at the Queensland Performing Arts Centre.
All right, guys, stand by.
Bradley, was now the right time to come to ACPA?
Yes, I think so. I just sort of was at a job in Townsville where I was rehearsal director there for the last almost 5 years and teaching a lot and teaching professionals, but I think I've just got a little bit more to give to a bit more people en masse.
Bradley, you've been here for a little while now, getting to know the landscape, as it were, and what have you noticed so far about ACPA and the dancers that you're getting to work with and see?
Well, what I've noticed so far is we actually just came off our end-of-year production last week, and I think it was a really great time for me to come in. A couple of months ago, after 3 weeks of being here, they started work on their end-of-year production. And I think that's where the students really came into themselves, and they show you why they're here, and they show you the amount of dedication and passion they have for their art form, whether it be dance, music or drama.
One of the things that we've come to expect from ACPA particularly is that urban experience of what it means to be an Aboriginal and or Torres Strait Islander. And Black Electric was about that experience once again. How important is it for that voice to be heard from particularly students like this at ACPA who've come from their communities, wherever they might be, into a city, but this is the experience that they're living?
Well, I think it's a great experience for them to come from community to here. And, you know, as well as getting trained in a lot of other genres that I guess they're not used to in community, where their focus is more on their cultural training, here they get to do a bit of the blend and the fusion with it. I know a lot of people don't like using the word fusion and cultural together, but they just get a bit of a blend and a bit more training and technique in other genres, but still maintaining their cultural heritage.
And how important is that in particularly being a dancer, maintaining that connection to culture?
Well, I think it's really important, and I guess it's important for different people in different ways. A lot of people have such a strong connection to culture if they've come from more community region, and other people in urban are just learning about it, really. So there's that real cross barrier of people that already know their culture and people that are brought up in the city or an urban environment that are not so familiar with their culture, and they're learning about it while they're here. And it's great for those students from community to be able to teach the other ones as well.
Bradley, I want to take you back to those first years of dance, and what was it like growing up in Mordialloc?
Well, growing up in Mordialloc was, you know, it was just sort of a normal environment for a kid to grow up in the suburbs, really. You know, I've got two older brothers and a sister, and I'm the youngest, so, you know, it was just that whole thing of fighting each other off in the morning to get to school, to get to the basin, who's having toast or the hot chocolate or whatever you got, or who's running out the door with their shoes left in the car, you know, all that sort of stuff. So it was just sort of a normal, natural, really suburban upbringing.
And when did you know that dance was what you wanted to do?
Well, I guess, I mean, I did it from, I can't really remember how old I was, maybe 7 or something like that. I don't know, I'll have to ask Mum. I guess when I was in my teens, early teens, where you get a lot more performance experience and stuff like that. And then I got accepted into the Australian Ballet School when I was 15. And I thought, well, okay, if this is what you're going to do, now's the time to buckle down and pull your finger out and do it.
And that was 1988, and I mean, what was the Australian Ballet School like in 1988 for someone like you?
Well, it was quite a daunting experience. We went in while Dame Margaret Scott was still the director of the school. They just had moved from their old tyre factory premises in Flemington to their new, brand new building in South Bank in Melbourne. And we're also young too, and I think that's the thing. You know, we had people coming from all around Australia and also Melbourne. We're all just so young and we're all there for the same reason. And I think it was the first time that, you know, I communicated with kids that we're all our goals were the same. We're all focused to do the same thing. It wasn't a competitive environment, but it was nice to be around people, I guess, like the students here at ACPA, where they all have the same dream and goals in life.
And you don't have to explain yourself.
Exactly. You don't have to explain yourself why you're leaving, you know, a class in Year 10 to go and do an exam or in a Stedford or something like that.
So what was a normal day for you at 15 at that school?
A normal day was we had class at 9 o'clock and we had four classes during the day, pretty much similar here to ACPA. We were at school from 9 o'clock in the morning until 4:45 at night. The classes mainly were ballet in the morning. We did contemporary, we did character, we did pas de deux, we did repertoire, we did all sorts of things. Classes were probably a little bit longer, but, you know, being really nerdy children like we probably were at school, you know, 2 hours before 9 o'clock. We got there quite early to have a peanut butter roll and a cup of coffee and talk about ballet. How nerdy is that?
But it's not just ballet that you started off doing. You did do jazz and you did do tap.
Yes, I did. I did jazz, and I did jazz all the way up through, which turned into modern, which turns in contemporary is what they now use, and I did tap as well until I grew out of my shoes and then I didn't want to buy another pair, so I stopped.
It's a good enough excuse.
Well, I think my parents were really happy about that.
Because dance can be quite expensive.
Oh, it's very expensive, and I'm not quite sure what people pay for classes and stuff now at ballet schools, but shoes, dance training, jazz, tap, ballet, I mean, they all cost a lot of money to be a part of. And you know, if there's more than one kid in the family and they all want to do the same thing, it can be a quite expensive hobby, I guess, to pursue.
As well as exams and then a Stedford's on top of that.
And costumes and makeup and everything else, yeah.
So after you finished at the ballet school, you got the chance to go off and dance in Hong Kong. What was that experience like?
Well, the thing with going to Hong Kong is I left school early, actually. I did graduate, but I left school early because this job had come up. So I saw it, and I was always interested in travel, so I saw it as an opportunity to do something that I didn't necessarily think that was right for me to do or necessarily think that I wanted to do, but I did it anyway because I knew it was going to be a great experience. And it was. It was a terrific experience. I lived in Hong Kong for a year, and I was in a classical ballet company there. But after a year, I'd done most of the repertoire with Swan Lakes and Nutcrackers and Sleeping Beauties and Les Sylphides and all those sort of things that I'd sort of experienced what I'd really had to experience from a classical dancer and being the physicality that I have as well, and knew that that's all I'd be doing if I stayed in a classical ballet company.
But was that a good experience for you to get to know yourself a little bit better in terms of what you liked to dance?
Yeah, I think so. And of course, it's being away from home, family, friends. I think it's just a great experience to learn and to learn how to fend for yourself in an environment that's quite... Hong Kong's not the easiest place to live in. It's not the cheapest place to live in. So he had quite a lot of struggles with language and stuff like that. But look, if you're going to learn anything, you may as well get thrown in at the deep end, hey?
You then eventually came back to Australia and got the chance to join the Sydney Dance Company and work under Graham Murphy. What is he like to work with?
Well, Graham's a great man to work with. He creates works that individually tailor your personality and your body. So most of the works that were created in Sydney Dance Company were created on me and I guess for me as a performer, as well as whoever else was in the company at that time. So it was great to go to work every day and get to know that you're the one that you've been created on and this piece is created for you to suit your body, your technical ability and your personality.
And is that one thing that makes working under someone like that so great, is that recognition that not everyone is the same, not all dancers are made the same. You all come with your own different quirks and being able to tailor something to you and understanding that?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess Sydney Dance Company back in that era was really about such different people from such different walks of life, heights, physicality, body shapes, personality. It just made it such an interesting place to work. And we did a lot of character-based works or ballets back then as well. So it was a really exciting period to be part of Sydney Dance Company.
From there, you get your next round of travel as well and got to travel to some amazing places as part of SDC. And that experience, I mean, what did that teach you after the Hong Kong and living in Hong Kong? And what did that open up for you? Was that a more of a chance to see more of the world, but also to see some different dances from other parts of the world and what they were doing?
Yeah, well, I mean, during that time that I was there, I mean, we toured so many places, and my first big trip was France for 5 weeks, and we toured everywhere, including Paris and South America. And then, you know, we went to Taipei and Japan, and we've travelled all across America and South America, Mexico, all through China and Europe, Germany and stuff. So we did quite a lot of stuff. Unfortunately, getting out to see a lot of other dance at that time is really sort of low on the agenda because our time is so limited. But when we did get the occasional day free, we'd probably go and see a show, whether it be high performance art or local culture in China or Peking Opera or something like that. So there was very sort of rare opportunities, unless we were invited as well, to go and witness those things, because we were working so much and had very little downtime.
And did you find that when you went to different countries, you viewed it in a different way, bringing your Gamilaroi self into it, that, you know, there was a different understanding of culture there, but one that you had some similarities with in trying to gain a better understanding of where you were visiting?
Yeah, I guess that's right. I think, you know, if you come from a cultured area, or whether, you know, Australians have such a different culture, unless you say you're from community or something. So going to other places where provincial China had this culture, and it's been like that for so many years as well, hundreds to tens of thousands and stuff. So it's really interesting to go and see the culture, especially the way they communicate with each other as family and stuff, but also each region also had their own different ways of expressing themselves through dance and through song as well, especially in places like China and Mexico and South America, you know, because they were very big on that celebration of their culture and stuff like that.
And what is the arts and dance in particular like in South Korea? I mean, what is its place?
Good question. They do have a lot of art. They have a lot of dance, and they also love their musical theatre, as I was over there with Katz. So I think Katz is back there again now, and it's been back twice since. And this was, you know, 10 years ago, and they bring Phantom of the Opera over. They do love their musicals. Graham Murphy and Janet Vernon actually are going over there next year to create a modern Giselle for a company over there. So that'll be a really giant step in South Korea to have a sort of modern classic told, which I think, you know, goes against the grain a little bit as well.
And so really like their Western musicals.
They do. They love them. They absolutely love them.
And when it comes to dance, I mean, dance jobs at the moment, it seems as though there's a lot of dancers out there and not many jobs happening. Do you feel that you've been quite lucky again in the types of work that you've been able to perform and been able to be a part of?
Well, I guess we were having a meeting about this the other day, and it's really hard to get your foot in the door as a professional dancer now in Australia, because a lot of dancers are actually just going from company to company. So there's no real new contracts that come up and that are available for people to join companies, unless, you know, they've been around and you know, someone gets injured, and that's how people usually get a lot of jobs these days. So unfortunately, there's not a lot of moments where straight out of school you get a chance to get a job in a professional company. A lot of project-based performances and stuff are great for students to do once they leave, but it is a difficult road, and I guess we've just got to give them the correct tools to be equipped to deal with that situation.
And it seems as though a lot of Australian dancers in particular too are being targeted by a lot of those international groups that are looking for dancers, whether it's the cruise ship route, whether it's Universal Studios in Japan. There always seems to be work
on offer, and a lot of these auditions are now coming to Australia because Australian dancers are known as some of the best trained.
Well, that's correct. I mean, there's so many dancers working in Europe, and there always has been so many dancers working in Europe. There have been a lot of dancers working in America too, but also that's difficult to get visas to work in America, so that sort of keeps people away a little bit. But you go through Europe, any town in Germany that you'll stop at where there's an arts organisation, there'll be an Australian there. It's the same thing throughout Austria and places that all those small towns have arts companies, they have opera companies, and there's always an Australian in every single one of those towns that you'll ever go through. Australians are everywhere throughout Europe because they are well trained, they are well respected, and they are known to be hard workers.
Bradley, when you look back on your career, what is one of the things that you think, man, I can't believe I did that?
Well, I guess it's just the whole thing, really. I mean, when you start off your career, you never know where it's going to take you. You never know whether you're going to work for a little while, work for a year or so, give up, do it. I mean, I was constantly changing. I'm like, I'm retiring next year. This was at 25, you know. I'm like, why? And I'm like, I don't know. It's just about the right time to give up, you know. And then you just keep changing your mind. And you do another work that puts more passion inside you, or you tour somewhere where you think, no, I'm not giving this up. So it constantly changed. And I guess I was lucky enough to perform until I was 38. Actually, I did a performance this year when I was 42, but that won't be happening again probably. It's just too much recovery time now. But I guess with each step that you take and every journey that you have, while you can still do it, I'd say to urge anybody to do it while you still can, because you never know what's around the corner. Injuries could prevent you from stopping at any moment, and or family or anything. So I just suggest to do it for as long as you can and just enjoy it while you can.
And with that performance that you did when you were in your, we won't say, but was there a change in the fitness level?
I don't think there's a change in the fitness level. I think, and your determination is still there. It's just that your body doesn't necessarily do what you tell it to anymore. And I guess that's just one thing that's frustrating. So, yeah, I think that's the thing. I mean, you know, I had almost 5 years off as well. So I guess if I hadn't had the fight, if it was 2 years or something like that, it probably would have been different. But taking 5 years off and going back to it is, and at my age, was quite difficult.
Robin enters carrying a Subway sandwich. He sees Kai and decides to eat his Subway on the bench as well. Kai is clearly upset, so Robin hands him half of the Subway. They eat for a while before Robin stands to leave. Kai hands him the bottle of gin and stays to finish the sub. Robin exits. And we have a song and dance. Black electric to end.
When it comes to awards, Bradley, you've had a few. You've had a Green Room Award, you've had an Australian Dance Award, and you've had a MOL Award. What did that mean for you, being recognised as Best Male Dancer?
Well, it's quite nice to be recognised. And I guess, you know, when I got those awards, I got them all in the same year. I think it was for 2003/2004 circuit performing. And, you know, I'd been dancing in Australia for 13 years, I suppose, at that stage. Even though I'd been nominated before, which is always quite nice, it's just nice to win one and be recognised for what you've been doing. And it's not just an overnight achievement. You know, I'd been working, as I said, for 13 years in the industry at that point, in Australia, plus overseas. So it's just nice to be recognised that you think that people know how hard it is, but are rewarding you for your hard work.
And you mentioned the nominations because you were nominated a number of times. So it's sort of, this was your moment of not being the bridesmaid.
Yes. Well, we had a joke because the first one that I won, I was living in Korea, actually. I was doing Cats and I got a call saying, you won. And everyone was like, oh, finally, because they used to call me the Meryl Streep of the Australian Dance Awards circuit. You know, always nominated but never won. So I was known as the Meryl Streep of dance in Australia because I was nominated so many times but never won. The Helpmans as well, nominated 4 times, never won. It's a shame. Maybe they'll give me one at Services to Dance in 20 years' time. I'll finally get one.
So through all of this, what has your family reaction been to your career? Did they think that it would last this long? Did they think that you'd eventually move on to something else, or have they been there with you every step of the way?
Well, look, my family have been 100% supportive. You know, I haven't lived with my family for over 25 years, so it's always been that long-distance support. I guess they've just supported me in doing whatever I've wanted to do, and they have. They've never questioned anything, even if they thought I was making the wrong decision. But, you know, I guess those wrong decisions are mine to make. And, you know, those decisions you learn from, and you learn from it and you put it behind you and you move on. But they've been terribly supportive. I mean, they always came up to Sydney to see me, or when we were in Melbourne to see me perform. But they've just been a great support throughout the whole thing. And I guess you need that little bit of support, because even if you are going in a different direction, I guess, that they saw for you, but still support you 100%, I guess that takes courage on their part as well.
And it must have taken a lot of courage too to let their 15-year-old son, the youngest in the family, go off and join a dance school.
Yeah, I guess so. But I guess once we decided that that's what I wanted to do, I think that was the decision that was made. And I guess that's the last decision that I think we made together, I guess, because I was underage, so I had to get them to sign the papers. But after that, once I got the job in Hong Kong, I sort of didn't necessarily ask. I just said, well, I've got this job and I'm taking it. So I guess from that moment on, I guess I always made decisions of what I was going to do, but just being quietly supported by the family, I guess. You know, they're not from the industry. They don't know how it works, so I guess all they can do really is be supportive.
In the time that you've been in the industry, Bradley, I mean, what have you seen in terms of the next generation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander dancers coming through those ranks, and the ones that don't necessarily go on to dance with Bangarra, but they're like you, forged a career within those mainstream companies, have gone overseas and have seen the world, and just working on their careers quietly?
Well, I guess each person follows their path and has their journey in their own way. I guess as we just quietly go along, we never realise what we're actually doing at the time until you can sort of look back on it in retrospect and think, oh, I did that, or, you know, oh, God, how did I manage to do that? I guess you never really think about it. I never really planned to have a great future. I always just really planned to have a great present and work towards what I could work upon. I never saw myself in 5 years down the track or 10 years down the track. That was always too far, and I said, in this business, you never know what's going to happen the next day. I think with the next generation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island dancers, I think with institutions such as ACPA and NASDA, I think we're providing Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders dancers and cultural and community performers with the correct tools that they need to go out and carve their own way in this business. Some of the dancers don't necessarily want to become professional dancers or contemporary dancers. Some dancers are learning the tools that they need to go back into community to teach cultural, to teach hip-hop, to teach contemporary. So there's different array of students here that come here for their own different purpose, and as long as they know what that purpose is, we can provide them with the correct tools and knowledge they'll need to forge their own way and their own future in this industry.
Do you think it's only a matter of time before we start seeing some of those Indigenous dancers branching out into some of those different disciplines that we haven't seen before? And one thing that we were talking about earlier about ACPA is that innovation in the end of year performances that they've been doing. NASDA's just had a visiting US choreographer come over as part of their end of year performance. And we're starting to see a lot of that collaboration happen with whether it's other dancers of colour or other Indigenous dancers of colour. Do you see that that's one thing that Indigenous Australians bring, is that innovation to the disciplines that they choose to work through and in?
Absolutely. And I guess with bringing over people to choreograph or direct from America or Europe or anything, is that you are expanding their horizons and say, look, even though you're being taught here, your path may lead you somewhere else. So you have to be prepared to travel, to follow your dreams and to make your dreams become a reality.
Well, it's interesting, Bradley, because you mentioned there that you have to have really an open mind as to where the work is going to take you, and it might not just be working in Brisbane, for instance.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, you have to go where the work is. And I mean, that's the thing that a lot of people just sort of don't tune into. They think, well, I'm training here, I'll get a job after this. And it's not necessarily the case. I mean, you may have to travel just to Sydney or to Melbourne or any of the major companies or performance groups around Australia, but then you may decide that you've got all this knowledge and you've got the technique and you've got the ability. Why not go and work in Europe? Why not try your luck in America? There's nothing that they can't do, and I think that's just instilling that idea in them that there's nothing they can't do if they put their mind to it.
And on that, Bradley, I mean, what are some of the challenges that you think still exist for dancers, regardless of whether they're Indigenous or not?
Well, I think some of the challenges that exist are challenges that they've always probably had, we've always probably had, but they've been passed down and they're in the minds of some young people think, well, I might not do that because it might be different, it might be too challenging, it might be too confronting. And I think the thing is just to wipe that all away and have the courage to go and do it. I mean, every step that you take and every experience you have with auditions or knockback, stepbacks, acceptances is always going to be a learning curve for your future. I mean, it's what makes you and what defines you in your journey through, you know, your life to become an artist or a singer or a musician or anything that you're being training to do. It's, you know, with every step forward, there's always a couple of steps back. And I think that, you know, when you look back on the career that I've had and think, oh, it's been absolutely great, but it always hasn't been moving forward. There's always those setbacks to make you continue to making you move forward and to make you more determined to get where you're going to go without the thought of like, oh, that's going to be too difficult, I'm not going to go and do that. The difficult things are the ones that teach you the most.
Do you remember that first time you got a knockback and how that felt?
I did, and it wasn't good. I think the first one when I was 15, and I was going for, it was a Shikini Medal performance, and we had the auditions and everything, and then they said, oh, no, and I was like, so disappointed, you know, and it was for a performance. I thought, oh, well, I'm too short, obviously. But then about 3 days later, they did ring up and say that I was accepted. But it's that initial disappointment that I always still feel. And it's not the joy that I felt of being accepted about after 3 days. It was the initial disappointment of not being accepted first is that what I remember more so. And I guess that just sort of spurs you on. And I guess if you do get knocked back, you always want to know why, because if you don't know why, then you can't improve on yourself or find out and then move forward and improve it for the next time. And I think that's the thing. When you go for auditions, you do get knocked back. You don't very often get a reason of why you get knocked back. So I think it's just that determination just to keep going.
Who were some of those dancers that you, I suppose not looked up to, but dancers whose styles you felt an affiliation to or who you really enjoyed watching?
Well, that's a really tough one, actually, because, you know, I grew up with people like Mikhail Brezhnikov. I didn't really go to dancing when I was younger because we couldn't afford it. I did when I went to the Australian Ballet School, only because we got free tickets to all the Australian Ballet performances. So I only started watching dance when I was about 15, 16, because we got free tickets to go to the shows. But before that, I grew up with people like Mikhail Brezhnikov. And then, you know, when after seeing shows, there was Graham Murphy and Janet Vernon and Sydney Dance Company of the late 80s and 1990 before I joined them. You know, and Stephen Page was still there then and Kim Walker and all those guys that made sort of Sydney Dance Company. They're very stylish, hip, I want to be part of that company for all the young and upcoming dancers was... They were sort of the inspiration. They were like, oh, my God, they're so cool. I want to be just like that, you know. I want to be me, but just like that. Or I want to be me, but part of that.
And when you were there, did you ever think that you'd reach that cool?
No, I don't think so. I guess once you're in it and you're not on the outside looking in anymore, it's not just a job, but I think you're too busy to realise what you're doing. I mean, you know, we created 4 new full-length works every year and plus toured works and stuff. So you never really were on the outside looking in. When you're in there and thinking, God, this is how hard work. I only hope I'm making it look as this cool as what they did to me, you know, to other people that maybe wanted to join the company.
And have you had anyone come up and say that to you and said, Bradley, you're the whole reason I saw you in X and that's the whole reason I decided to dance?
I don't think I've started anyone's career. I guess I've kept them doing classes because it's, I guess they've just, seen things and wanted to achieve some great stuff also. And I guess it's just made them determined to stay in their classes and improve on their technique and their abilities to get to a level of where they can do that. And, you know, I never strive to be the best. I've just strived to be the best that I could be. And I think that's the difference with some people's mindset. If you're always striving to be the best, you're always pushing yourself. And I think you go just that too far beyond, you've lost sight of what you're actually doing. But to be the best that you can be, the best that I can be, is achievable.
You mentioned Baryshnikov, and one thing that we've seen lately is a lack of male principal dancers around the world and a real shortage of them. But it's unusual also to find an Indigenous Australian ballet male dancer.
Yeah. I suppose in the Indigenous community, a lot of the dancers start late as well with their technique classes and stuff. And I guess that may have something to do with it. So we need to sort of get them into classes when they're a little bit younger, just to instill those early technical things that you need when you're young and not so rebellious. So I think that would be great if we can get kids in classes a little earlier, because especially with the male dancers, they don't start till late, and they often start with hip-hop or crump or something like that now, which is great, and they move so well. But then once they come to organisations like ACPA or NASDA, then they have to go backwards, even though they move tremendously well, and learn the technical abilities that come with ballet and contemporary.
And it's interesting because Misty Copeland is another African-American ballet dancer with the American Ballet Theatre who started late. She was in her late teens, from what I understand, and was told that she would never be a dancer. She didn't have the body for it, and is someone who is actively trying to change the diversity that we see in ballet companies, particularly in the US.
With things like that, I mean, she premiered as the first African-American Swan Lake here in Brisbane, actually. And then I saw her the next night when they did their triple bill program. I guess being told constantly that it's not going to happen for you, I think when you're younger, because I was told that as well because I'm quite short, it goes in, but to some people it does completely block them and stop them, and it just really screws with their head and having trouble finding their way forward. But to me, I listened to it, but I never really took it on board. I never really believed it, and I guess that she didn't either. I never really believed what people were telling me, that it's, I'm not going to do it because I'm too short, or she wasn't going to do it because her, you know, same thing, or her body is not physically built for ballet or whatever. And I never went out to prove a point to prove them wrong. I just thought what they were saying was incorrect.
But to have that type of confidence can sometimes be rare, and, you know, to have that when you had it at such a young age as well, to be able to say, look, I get that I'm short, I'm never going to be Baryshnikov or Nureyev, but I'm just me.
Yeah. Well, I just thought when they were saying it, I was like, well, there's nothing I can do about my height. It's like, it's not like I can go on a stretching rack or anything. I can get those implants and get my, you know, shins lengthened like they do in some places now. I'm just like, well, there's nothing, what do you want me to do about it? There's nothing I can do about it. I can just dance to the best of my ability, but I can't grow. So I just never really understood it.
And it's interesting because being told that you've had such a long career and have got many jobs regardless of your height.
Exactly. And I think my height has been the reason why. You know, there's always a suitable place for everybody somewhere. And I guess I just found it at Sydney Dance Company.
Bradley, what would be your advice from what you've learnt in your dance career that you think is important to pass on to the next generation? I mean, what are your tips with trying to pursue a career in dance?
I guess the thing is just to listen to those people that are trying to help you, whether they be teachers, family or friends. But I think with gaining the knowledge that you do while you're being trained, and it's really important to maintain that and to hold on to that, because years later you'll come back in life and you'll be doing something and you'll think, oh God, why didn't I listen in that? Now I can't remember the appropriate way to do this, or even if it was about dance history, I should know this. Like, it's always just being aware and to listen. I know you're going to have your off days, especially as we all did when we're students, and sometimes we think, God, I just don't want to be here today. And they're really hard days to get through. But if you can get through those days and concentrate on the other, you know, the majority of the days that you are there, I think it's just keep learning the knowledge and keeping the knowledge, because eventually you're going to be passing the knowledge on. and hopefully in a bigger and better way that you've received it sometimes.
That was award-winning Gamilaroi dancer and choreographer Bradley Chatfield talking about his career and new appointment as the head of dance at ACPA, the Aboriginal Centre for the Performing Arts, which is based in Brisbane. You're listening to Away on RN and on the ABC's International Service, Radio Australia, with me, Rhianna Patrick.